Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pulse.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 98 through 100 of Part 7. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will occasionally reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get started, we have Hallmarked Man news.
We do.
Jo said on Twitter on April 28th that she's still currently in February 2017 and that Strike is in a bar and that Robin was at home and that she's still making progress. That just makes me think about when Jo was tweeting about Ink Black Heart and talked about Strike being in a bar, aka Annabelle's, in 2016. Maybe it's another Annabelle sort of situation where he's there for surveillance and, I don't know, maybe even rejecting the advances of a woman he knows won't be good for him to parallel Ink Black Heart. Maybe. Ooh. But that could be a little too on the nose.
I immediately was worried when I heard this news. I was like, what do you mean he's at a bar? How dare he? Mm-hmm. But then the things you said that are rational thoughts stopped that spiral. And I thought, yeah, this must be for surveillance of some kind, right? Mm-hmm. I love your idea of that reverse parallel with Annabelle's. But I'm really curious about what Robin's up to at home. Like, who is she with? Is she alone? Is she working on the case? Is she having a bubble bath? What's she doing?
She better not be with Ryan.
I better not be at this point, yeah.
Yeah, I think I've seen some people speculate about Strike being on the prowl for another girlfriend or one-night stand or whatever. But this seems honestly super unlikely to me after his vow in Running Grave.
There's a lot of worst case scenario predicting going on. Mm-hmm. I didn't think anything really about this at all. It could be anything, right? How often is Strike in a pub for literally any reason? You know, Robin could be getting home from surveillance or on a day off. I don't know. This tweet did not lead me to jump to any negative conclusions.
I think it was the difference between the bar and pub, because the bar is different from the pub. The pub is like that homey space where he does work, right? But a bar is much more like social and datey.
It doesn't change anything for me.
Yeah, it seems unlikely that he's going to be reversing course on the progress that he made in the previous book. So, but anyway, moving on May 4th, we originally had gotten an interview with Jo in the Times where she talks about both writing Harry Potter and writing Strike. It's a really great interview. We have all of this linked over on our Twitter. And our handle is at the SE Files Pod if you want to check it out.
Yeah, I was a little confused by what this interview was for. You know, was it actually for the Times or was it something that she and her team did and then they reprinted it? Because it seems like it was done for her website because everything is on her website under, I think the category is like on writing or something. But yes, the videos are in three parts on her website. There's a lot of Strike related stuff that we have to talk about.
Yes. There were a couple of interesting tidbits about Strike that I wanted to touch on. The first being, and I think that this is probably the most important, that she wrote the final chapter of The Hallmarked Man before the first one. And not only that, but it's also a very important final chapter for the whole series. One thing I'm certain of is that this ending is going to kill us.
Yeah, I lost my entire mind over this.
Yeah,
I was actually awake when this was released because I was still sick and I was coughing and I couldn't sleep. And after I heard that, I didn't want to sleep. How could I?
Right?
For her to say that, it's a big deal.
That's a big deal. It's huge. Huge news. Momentous. I feel like for her to say that, this chapter must be the turning point. The moment that everything changes on their emotional journeys or whatever. It has to be that significant for her to be writing it first.
When she talked about how the ending will make sense if you read the book and see the thread follow through to the end, or however she worded it. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It instantly made me think of how she writes in this circular way. You know, in The Running Grave, we get that beginning part where Strike is wondering if he'll ever tell Robin how he feels about her and then telling her at the end. And it might be obvious to say that I think we can expect that again, but that's what it made me think of. And those threads are usually relationship things. I know a lot of people are thinking that this is a Leda thing, but the final chapters have always been Strike and Robin moments. I went through each of them in my head to make sure I was right. And yeah, I mean, I'm doing everything to manage my expectations, but I can't help but believe we're going to get a very significant relationship moment at the end. I'm still predicting either an I love you too from Robin, a kiss, maybe both, some sort of significant decision to move this forward.
Yeah. With this news, I'm leaning more and more towards the idea we had that they'll talk about things early on in the book, but Robin, afraid of losing what they have, will be like, we can't do this. So they agree not to act on their feelings. And then we get a whole book of that delicious tension where they both know what the other one feels, but can't do anything about it. And then when the climax of the book hits with, you know, some kind of danger, suddenly it's clear by the end that this is worth the risk. So this final chapter, I feel like they're going to decide to go for it. That's what I'm predicting.
I feel less sure of this now, just because Robin does want this.
Mm-hmm.
She's thought to herself about the intimacy that she craved with him.
She's afraid of it going wrong.
Her no is because she's afraid that Strike doesn't want it.
And I think that Strike has come to the conclusion by the end of Running Grape that it is worth the risk to him.
I just don't see how they can go the whole book without talking about it. So then where does it leave us but this?
I mean, I don't know. I cannot see Robin being like, no, all of a sudden don't want this intimacy that I admitted I wanted before.
Well, if she's still afraid that it wouldn't work out.
I don't think she's ever afraid that things just don't work out like he is. She's afraid that he doesn't want it.
I guess we'll find out when the book comes out.
Okay, so other things that she mentioned. She said that she has an enormous amount of backstory just to keep herself orientated while she's writing, even if it never comes up in the books. So, for example, she knows exactly where Strikes lived. Big chunk of things about Leda's life, where she ran away to, who she slept with, who she wanted to sleep with, etc., etc., just to get a better feel for who she was as a person.
Also, what concert she ran away to. For some reason, I want to know that.
Oh, yeah, me too. I bet that concert list is quite extensive.
It's probably connected to real concerts. Do you know what I mean? It's just interesting. Mm-hmm. I think this is something we've known, but I love hearing the added details about the kinds of things that come to mind for Joe when thinking about what adds to Leda's character.
I can't believe we might never know this stuff. Could she publish like an encyclopedia or something?
Don't say the E word. It didn't work out well for Harry Potter. Don't say it.
True. I'm so curious about the Nancarrow parents, though. I really want to know about Ted and Leda's parents.
And I know I've said this before, but her doing this and having this kind of knowledge of her characters is one thing that I've always thought makes them all feel so real. And it's what helps us as readers build such a connection with them.
She also says, while plots have occasionally thrown her a curveball, she said that she has an understanding with her characters. They don't misbehave, and she doesn't put them through too much hell.
That's funny.
Guess that rules out any tinfoil pregnancy theories then.
Oh, does it? I didn't even think about that. I guess that would be considered too much hell, wouldn't it?
A little bit.
I like this, though. I enjoy her saying that she knows her characters very well.
So another interesting thing that she said is that she originally thought that Charlotte was going to die in The Hallmarked Man, but ended up doing it in Running Grave instead.
Yeah, this was so funny.
Yeah, yeah. I'm laughing at the fact that we collectively, as a fandom, just forgot that Charlotte died in Running Grave.
This was so funny to me because I had to take a second to think about who died. Right? Yeah. Who is she talking about? And then I kept laughing every time I saw a comment from someone else asking, who died? I think it's because we immediately assumed it would be someone we'd be sad about, you know? Because she went from talking about Lupin and Tonks and Fred to mentioning this death in the Running Grave. So it was a hard switch of, oh my God, Fred, to who? I didn't feel that way about anybody. What are you talking about?
I didn't notice.
It was like, just so funny.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me that she pushed Charlotte's death forward a book. I'm intrigued as to why. I guess she needed Strike to have his big emotional revelation sooner. Maybe because she's planning to move their relationship forward in the next book. Or another option, there could be another big death coming in The Hallmarked Man and she didn't want to have two in one book.
I guess it depends on when she thought it would be an eight. Yeah, because she could have plotted out originally and then, you know, getting closer down the line thought, oh, this would be better here.
Yeah.
But I'm glad it happened in seven.
Me too. Big time.
That sounds terrible.
I'm just saying, I'm so glad we don't have to worry about Charlotte anymore.
So she also mentions Rokeby maybe being potentially important in Hallmarked Man. I can't remember exactly how she brought it up. Lindsay, do you remember?
Well, the Rokeby stuff could be important if she was speaking literally, because she said something about, oh, that'll be important later in book eight, or this will be important later in 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah, that was because her editor said that he didn't like Strike having a famous dad or something like that.
Yeah, so it's hard to know because I don't think Brokeby was important in seven. So I she could just be talking generally, this will be important later on, and she just picked a number. She did say eight another time, so there is potential for Brokeby to be an eight, but we just don't know if she's speaking literally or not.
Oh, and this one was a really exciting one. Strike and Robin not having access to a DNA lab is going to be a problem in the Hallmarked Man.
Yeah, this has been fun for me to try and speculate what kind of forensic evidence they want to investigate or need to investigate. Do they have DNA from a suspect that they can't compare? Or is my idea of an unidentified victim still possible?
Ooh, I hope that that is true. With the unidentified victim, that would be really fun.
This kind of leaves it still open for me that it could be. Either way, I think a lot of us are wondering if this means we're going to see Oliver again.
Ooh, I hope so. I hope we are. Because I want to see Vanessa. Like, how is she doing?
That'd
be
a good Lethal White parallel.
She and Robin still close? I need updates.
Oh, this next bit was really sweet. Whenever she was creating the characters of Strike and Robin and her realizing that there were going to be two Holmeses in the series instead of a Holmes and a Watson.
Yeah, I loved that
so much. I don't even have words. Holmes and Holmes. Very cute.
She also comments on this being a 10-book series and says that she has a very clear idea of how their relationship will go over those 10 books.
Love it.
Yeah. I just love that she makes a point of saying that this is what weaves those books together.
It is. And I feel like at this point, she's not even denying where this is going or pretending to be coy about it anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's literally said on Twitter to just be patient.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love that their relationship is the thread that ties everything together. They're the heart and soul of these books for her and for us.
Next, she talks about planning the books on her laptop, and I love that the clues are in blue.
That was such a cool thing that she showed us with that.
Like, can we just get a closer look at...
Yeah, can you zoom in a little bit there?
Yeah, like, I just want to see, like, she wouldn't even have to, you know, show me Hallmarked Man, show me a previous book. I don't care. I just want to see what it looks like.
It's just so cool. Clues, red herrings, all of that stuff.
Her comment about how when they're together, meaning Strike and Robin, stuff's always going on. That was super cute.
Did you notice her smile when she said that?
Oh, yeah.
She had a little smile. She ships them just like we do.
She loves mm-hmm. them together.
And I loved how she color codes how often they're each alone and when they're together so that it's balanced in the book.
She said that she's more involved with the cover design for the books than she has been in the past.
I'm going to need the Hallmark Man cover reveal now so I can speculate wildly. When has she become more involved? What is the timeline?
She just was talking about, I think, in comparison to how it used to be where authors were shown the cover. Oh, hope you like it. But it wasn't that she got
to
pick.
Now she gets input.
Yeah.
Next, she mentions writing about January 2017 and says something about how it's September 2023, but her mind is still stuck on a damp Monday and Tuesday in January 2017, 6 years prior. So I wonder how long ago it is that she's recorded this or if she's just talking generally.
Did she say it was in September 2023, but her mind was stuck in January 2017?
I think she was just saying, let's say it's this month.
It all depends on whether she's being literal or if she's just like,
or she could have been thinking of a specific incident.
Yeah, because if she was writing that time period back in September, it's a long time to be writing those 2 months.
Okay, lastly, something that I appreciate her saying as far as fandom influencing her writing. She says, personally, the truth is, I don't feel I owe anyone anything except the best story I can tell. That is my obligation to produce the best work I can.
This was my favorite thing she said. I've seen people worry before that she would be influenced by readers or commenters online that don't want Strike and Robin together. And I've always said, no. She's doing what she wants to do. This just confirms that we don't have to worry about things like that. No. And also, even the things I think I want are never as good as what she's doing. I love that she does this. I think it's great. I think the books are better for it.
She's a storyteller. She's a brilliant storyteller. So whatever she chooses to do, we're going to love.
Can I throw out a few things that I noticed in the interview?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I noticed instantly that Joe's nails were gray, which is also the color of the heart emoji she used when she posted the title, I think.
Oh.
It kind of makes me think of weather. Right? If she's in January, February.
Or gray could be pretty close to silver.
That makes a lot more sense. That's gray, probably silver. What it is. It's the silver connection. Yes. Mm. See, she is doing this. I think this is done purposely.
Why else would you wear gray nail polish, right? It's got to be a clue.
Well, I mean, not just a clue, but just the tone, because she's done this before, right? Where she wore the I Ching necklace.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing I'm curious about is from the third video. So she's wearing a sweater that says 1970 on it. I don't know if that's too out there to wonder about, but if 1970 is at all relevant in this book, I'm going to remember that.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye out for that date.
The last thing that I really liked is she talked a bit about a text exchange that she had with Tom Burke that I found really interesting. It was about the guitar decor piece that they have in the earlier adaptations on the wall. Mm-hmm. And he was asking her if Strike would want that. And she said, no, absolutely not. He would never. And I think we all know why he wouldn't want that. But Joe said that Tom Burke said to her that he doesn't think Strike consciously chose Denmark Street for the music connection, mm-hmm. but something about the familiarity of his childhood is what drew him to it. And I think you know why I'm bringing this up, because we know that Joe has said before that Robin is going to ask Strike about this very thing. So I was really interested to hear her kind of bring up that concept again. And also, I do love hearing that both Tom Burke and Holiday Grainger understand the characters the way that they do. Mm-hmm. Makes me feel like they care about them, you know, in the same way that we do, which is always nice to hear.
Yeah.
These were amazing videos. I was so excited to get them. So nice to see just her and her process. Blue is such a great color on her, too. She looks great in blue.
Oh, yes.
Right? 100%. Her eyes just pop.
Yeah. Should we get into the Q&A?
Yeah.
So this week's Q&A, the title, The Running Grave, is really intriguing. Can you shed some light on its significance and its connection to the story?
Well, The Running Grave is from a quotation by Dylan Thomas. When, like a running grave, time tracks you down. So for me, that the significance of that quotation is old deeds catching up with people, obviously also mortality catching up with people. So Strike's sense of his own mortality is important in this book. But interestingly, the Norfolk poet George Barker also used the phrase the running grave in his poem, and that is also mentioned in the book. So I think although it's given translators for this novel a huge headache because the running grave doesn't quite work in other languages, I love it. I think it's very evocative, the idea of the grave pursuing you like a wave, but also all of us knowing one day we must die, which can actually be a reminder to live. And that too is in this book. Strike really now starting to ask questions of himself about how he wants to spend the second half of his life. So it really worked for me.
I love the way she explains how this title works for both the case and the personal, because we love talking about things like that. Old deeds do catch up to the people who have done bad things in their past, the UHC mm-hmm. Abigail, but time is also catching up with Strike, and it's time to do something about it and pursue Robin.
Yeah.
Take his fate into his own hands.
I love that she brings up what a headache the title has given the translators, because I feel like it's been that way for the past couple of books. If I recall correctly, Ink Black Heart's title gave translators trouble too, but nothing like this.
Oh, you know what? That reminds me of another thing she said in those video interviews, that the mm-hmm. silkworm she originally wanted to call Bombyx Mori.
And they were like, no.
No, absolutely not.
Never heard that before, and I love that.
I also love that she mentioned Strike really giving thought to how he wants to spend the second half of his life, because we know who he's going to be spending it with.
You know, I don't know if I realized this before, but Dayu did actually end up in a running grave. The pigs running around on their little trotters. No. They were the running grave in the end.
Oh.
I just think it's weird that she didn't mention that in this answer. I guess it'd be a spoiler, but it works on a different level.
That's
I'm just funny. Saying.
I don't know what.
I mean, it's so horrifying, morbid, dark.
We were all thinking, it's the water. The water runs like a river.
It's little piggies on their trotters.
No. Yeah.
Running around on the farm.
Until, well.
Oh my God, they probably eventually slaughtered and ate those pigs.
Well, that's
corpse carrots, but way worse.
Well, I mean, someone eventually scooped that up instead.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But still, the nutrients, I guess it's pretty far removed, yeah. Anyways, not important.
Didn't think that Q&A would take us to pig poop, but here we are.
Not important.
All right.
All right, chapter 98. In this chapter, Strike and Robin debrief about their interview with Cherie. In the epigraph for this chapter, Khan means something deeply mysterious, and that is from hexagram 16, enthusiasm.
I think this is just Strike and Robin talking about how mysterious everything surrounding Cherie is and what she said in their interview with her. Mm-hmm. She's deeply mysterious.
It is. There's something deeply mysterious going on here. This is that enthusiasm hexagram again, the one that's represented Wace's control over his followers before. And I'm wondering if maybe It's a hint, a very subtle hint, that there is another waste behind Cherie Did. Because bear with me, so this line is actually from the commentaries on 16, the third part of the book. And it is referring to the nuclear trigrams of the hexagram. So remember when we broke down the I Ching, each hexagram has two trigrams. They're groups of three lines. One goes on top of the other to form the hexagram, right? Those are called the primary trigrams. And for enthusiasm, those are thunder above and earth below. But there are also, it turns out, nuclear trigrams. So basically how you get those is you take off the bottom line and the top line, and those four lines overlap to form the two nuclear trigrams. So lines 2, 3, 4 are one, and then lines 3, 4, 5 are the other, right? So these represent a hidden theme hidden inside the hexagram that impacts the primary interpretations. Like it's a theme within a theme, a mystery. So what this line here about Khan, it's referring to Khan, which is water, the abysmal. Okay. And the full bit that this is taken from says the nuclear trigram Ken is the door, and the nuclear trigram Khan means something deeply mysterious. This leads to the idea of the temple of the ancestors. So hidden within this hexagram is Khan, the abysmal water. So let's say that this hexagram generally represents waste, like the commander leading his armies with this enthusiasm. But in this use, it's referring to the secret hidden inside that, the door to something mysterious or dangerous, the door to the abysmal. Waste is the ancestor in the temple, and it's his descendant that is the answer to that deep mystery in this chapter. That hung together in my head when I was reading this before. I don't know how much sense it makes, but the hidden trigram is water, the abysmal. Considering how prominent that's been in this book, could be significant.
The chapter starts out with Strike immediately saying that he's hungry after they leave Cherie's house, which is relatable.
The very first thing he says. I love it. Also, what's the betting that subconsciously he just wants to stretch out the time he has with Robin? Because, of course, he doesn't want to jump right back on the road. So lunch is the best reason to dawdle.
Oh, yeah. It's just like earlier before she goes in.
Oh, my God. Remember, he picked out the little restaurant.
We even get a callback to that great line that calories don't count in the car.
Oh, it's so good. Both an iconic line and fantastic words of wisdom.
And I like when Robin suggests getting food to eat in the car. He says, as long as there's plenty of food.
You've got to get your money's worth when the calories don't count, right? Really pack it in, take full advantage of that loophole.
Right. You're not taking full advantage until you've eaten most of a cow and half a potato field.
It also reminds me of that part in Troubled Blood where they've just left the interview with Douthwaite in Skegness. That chapter also starts off with Strike saying he's hungry.
It is a little connection. I mean, being a brilliant detective works up an appetite.
The difference is, in Troubled Blood, Robin suggests fish and chips nearby, but now she wants to get away as soon as possible, and says she doesn't feel comfortable staying nearby.
This felt like a sign of the empathy that she has for Carrie that she had in that interview. I don't know, in making Robin feel this unease about staying close to this, Joe's kind of setting us up for the guilt she's going to feel later, maybe?
I don't think I read it as empathy for Carrie.
Yeah?
No, what do you think is making her uncomfortable?
I thought it was the combination of a few things. First, it was obvious to both Robin and Cormoran that Carrie was very obviously concealing something, that she's super sus. It basically confirmed Dayu's death wasn't an accident and that Carrie is involved. I think. But then the extreme distress that Carrie exhibited, you know, that slack face that Robin was spooked by at the end, and then that heavy presence of the woman's two adorable daughters sort of hanging over the interview. I don't know, I think Robin is kind of dreading what they're going to uncover about this and the impact it'll have on the family, maybe. Felt like she was uncomfortable with how upset Carrie was in that questioning.
I guess my thinking is that doesn't really explain, at least to me, why she wanted to get away so quickly. Mm-hmm. Because they've been suspicious of people before, but yeah. She's never felt uncomfortable staying in town. I feel like both Strike and Robin sense that something is following them, so to speak, because they knew Carrie had been warned that they were coming. And whether or not it was a conscious thought, I think Robin wants to get away from that scary connection to the UHC. I'm visualizing something like the smoke monster from Lost, just finding Strike and Robin in the car once Strike tells Abigail where they are, and then following them and settling over Carrie's house. And Robin is sensitive to it because she's seen that evil now. And I know that Abigail and the UHC are separate, but that evil has roots from the same place. I don't know if that makes sense, but for me, Robin wanted to get away and felt uncomfortable staying near because she felt like the infection from the UHC or that evil was drawing nearer and nearer. Yeah. And she wants to get away from it.
Yeah, I think I'm following you there. Mm-hmm. Also, that is a very creepy mental image. Having just finished Lost, it's like, oh, man.
Yeah, that's pretty vivid. Very creepy.
That's just how I see this evil that Robin is describing infecting other people. You know, it's following them and Robin is trying to outrun it. That's what it feels like to me.
Mm. All right. So then they start discussing their interview with Cherie.
I kind of love that they're having lunch and discussing this in the Land Rover. Mm. I think we're making up for Lost Land Rover time.
Oh, yeah. 100%. It really is a special place for them, isn't it?
Super special. I mean, it's the last thought she had before she almost died. That image in her mind of happiness and love wrapped up and just sitting beside Strike in this car. She's getting to live that again now when she thought that maybe she never would.
You know how lots of people are afraid of Roundtree dying or were sad about Wolfgang? For me,
yes,
I feel that way about the Land Rover.
It would be sad.
Kind of like their mini office, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're attached to it.
So much history in that car.
So while they're talking, they're discussing their interview with Cherie, they pretty much pick up on all the things that we pointed out in the last episode. Lindsay, you want to give us a quick rundown?
Cherie doesn't like talking about the night before the drowning, including Dayu being put out the window or the special drinks.
So from this, we can pretty much know for sure that Dayu didn't make it to the beach right at this point, or at least make a good guess, because why else would she have been smuggled out the window if not for it to have been the real last time she was seen, right?
I think so, yeah. I can't remember if I did put that together. I'm guessing not.
Well, of course not, but it is possible.
Right.
I think at this point, I was still thinking they just drowned a different kid, though.
They also picked up on how Cherie could have known Jordan Rini overslept and considered that she also drugged him. They haven't figured out that they were in it together yet.
Do you think that by this stage that they're in it together is figureoutable? Are the clues there that someone could piece this together? Because given the intense reaction of both Rini and Cherie to the questioning and the Polaroids, plus the info we've gotten here, I think the reader has enough to at least be very, very suspicious of both of them and probably think that maybe multiple people were involved, right?
Yeah, I think so. Another really important thing that points right to Abigail, again, is how Cherie wouldn't have had access to any kind of medication to make the kids drowsy. And we all know who the only person could have been.
You know, one of these days we'll get the clues the first time we read.
I seriously doubt that.
We've only got 3 books left.
3 more shots.
Unless we're right about the Gillespie thing, I'll count that as something.
I will absolutely count that. If we're right about that, I will crow it from the rooftops.
Put it in my Twitter bio.
That would be sweet. We guessed it. Oh, that would be so good. Coming back to this, Robin's idea that someone might have used plants to make the kids fall asleep was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked really well to direct our attention away from that thing that no one could go out to buy the cough medicine except, you know, who.
Yeah.
Because that scene with Lynn is fresh in our memories too. It was horrible. And I could totally believe that someone at the farm grew sleepy time herbs, you know?
You know what the most unbelievable part of this whole book I'm just realizing is?
Yeah.
How on earth, how did Cherie get all of those children to actually drink cough medicine? Has anyone tasted cough medicine before? Because it is literally the
most disgusting.
At 38, I refuse to take it.
Yeah, it's gross. The cherry flavored stuff is
the worst thing ever in the world.
Oh, it's so bad.
I don't think I've ever had a problem with it.
Oh my God.
I hate it.
Oh my God. It's awful. I mean, Jack will literally gag if he has a cold and I'm trying to get him to take medicine. How did she? That's impressive.
That is impressive.
I guess when children are told that they have to obey, you know, I guess like, that's the only reason because
they're used to the cult thing.
Yeah. They also consider the idea that Cherie drugged Dayu, and that's why she didn't want to get out of the car. The implication being that she drugged her and then took her to the beach to drown her. But Robin says that she just can't see Cherie doing this. Last time she said that with Gus, she got it wrong. But this time she's mostly right.
Yeah.
I really think it's the mother role Cherie embodies and how much Robin heard from so many people in Chapman Farm, how loving she was.
It's the one consistent personality trait we've seen from her. She likes kids. She's good with kids. It's stressed to us and to Robin and Cormoran. So yeah, Robin is reasonable in saying she can't see Sheree actually drowning a child. But with Gus, they really knew nothing about him. I feel like Robin was like projecting a personality onto him based on that musical skill and shyness. She's kind of like,
yeah,
imagining a little personality that didn't fit with reality because they didn't know anything about him really.
Yeah.
But with Sheree, they do know this.
The next bit is interesting where they start talking about women being capable of committing these horrible crimes because they've had this discussion before. They talked about this in Silkworm for sure, where we had a woman commit a super gross murder.
Yes.
So they start talking about this because of the Milgram experiment, and Strike is arguing that Sheree could have been persuaded to commit this crime. Participants were instructed to administer increasingly strong electric shocks to another person every time that person answered a question wrongly, and 65% continued turning up the dial until they were administering what they thought was a dangerously high level of electricity.
I thought the mention of this goes really well with the idea of cults and the control they have over people. I was reading about the results of this experiment and it said, "The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any length on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study and the fact most urgently demanding explanation. Ordinary people, simply doing their jobs and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process. Moreover, even when the destructive effects of their work become patently clear, and they are asked to carry out actions incompatible with fundamental standards of morality, relatively few people have the resources needed to resist authority." So this is very much in line with what we've seen the UHC do to people. And Robin even talks about feeling like she's become an agent of their evil or that she's infected and infecting other people.
Yeah. You know, what's kind of an interesting coincidence is that Milgram actually did this study. I believe I've got a book over here that I had from whenever I was an undergrad that talks about how he had done this experiment to begin with. Milgram's idea for this project grew out of his desire to investigate scientifically how people could be capable of carrying out great harm to others simply because they were ordered to do so. Milgram was referring specifically to the millions of hideous atrocities committed on command during World War II, but also more generally to the inhumanity that has been perpetuated throughout history by people following the orders of others.
It's a good question.
But you're right, Lindsay, this does fit with the UHC. In the experiment, people were perfectly able to walk away at any time. They'd get prodded by the instructor, but they could get up and walk out. But still, 65% of them obeyed. So is it any wonder that with added coercion and fear and control that the UHC brings to the table, that pretty much everyone at the farm does obey what they're told to do?
Yeah, no, of course.
It's not surprising.
I would like to think I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I like to think that as well. I like Robin's point that it was all men in the experiment because it's a blind spot that should be recognized more, right? Like in the Sanford Prison experiment, all the participants were men and yet the results get generalized to people. But it's just inaccurate to do that without the data, right? But in the case of the Milgram experiment, actually, they repeated the study with women. Like, I think Milgram did variations. Other studies have done mixed sex groups. And it turns out that, yeah, the obedience rate is pretty much exactly the same for women as for men, 65%. Although, interestingly, the women consistently had a higher level of tension and stress. The women obeyed at the same rate as the men, but they were more upset about it.
Is that better or worse?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
They have more of a conscience, but they're still willing to go against it. That's not great.
No.
Except there was one study that was done in Australia where men obeyed at 40% and women at 16%. And this study also had the lowest reported obedience rate at 28%. What's going on down there, Australia? What have you got in your water? Because good for you guys.
Spiders.
Rugged individualists. Spiders. Yeah. Probably the spiders influence it somehow.
You know, I have to mention what Strike brings up here with the Manson women.
Yes.
He's arguing to Robin that women are capable of horrific crimes, but particularly if they've been persuaded. So Strike mentions Patricia Carmichael and Susan Atkins. He can't remember the other's name, but her name is Leslie Van Houten, by the way. Is it okay if I just give a brief summary of the Manson murders? Because I do feel like there are parallels here when it comes to convincing other people to commit horrific crimes for you.
Yeah, tell us.
So this was absolutely a cult. And a lot of young people who ended up there for the same reasons that were given in this book, right? Running away from bad home situations like Sheree, looking for something more, in trouble with the law like Jordan Rini, all those kinds of things. But basically, through a lot of brainwashing and a lot of LSD, Charles Manson convinced his followers that there was an end of the world war coming. And that he received all of his divine information and instructions from the Bible, mostly the Book of Revelation, and through the music of the Beatles, particularly the White Album.
As one does,
yes.
Well, as one now receives all of our information directly from Taylor Swift. Telling us messages, secret messages.
So yes. You know how it goes.
Sure.
Just as a warning, the next part, it gets super racist.
Oh, great.
The whole idea of this war, according to Manson, was that it would be between the black and white communities. The Manson family was going to go to the desert because they were all white and waited out. And he believed that the black community would win, but that they wouldn't be able to run society. So that's when he and his followers would come out of hiding and take over. Yeah, but because weirdly, this wasn't happening, he told his followers that they needed to do something to start this war. So they committed these murders in an attempt to frame the black community. By the way, the framing attempt was putting one of the victims' wallets, I think, in the public bathroom in a black neighborhood. I think that's what happened. Real smart plan.
Wow.
Can't believe it didn't work.
Sophisticated false flag operation right there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
As a side note, I've always been curious if Manson actually believed any of this himself. I believe his followers did, but just like with Wace, I'm not totally convinced that Manson did.
Yeah.
I mean, if you watch anything on him, he's absolutely insane. But if I remember correctly, the house where Sharon Tate lived, the house where the first night of the murders took place, that house used to be owned by a music producer named Terry Melcher. And he had declined to sign Manson and give him a music deal, which angered him because he was actually a pretty good musician. You can listen to Manson's album on Apple Music or wherever. It's up there. We know that Whitaker did. So anyway, the idea is that Manson really wanted revenge, and that's why he picked this house. So I don't know if he believed in the whole helter-skelter war thing, or if he just used that as an excuse, but the followers believed it. And so the whole thing connects with Wace to me, where leaders of the cult might not believe the things they're saying, but they're pushing this idea of war coming to get people to believe them. And that's all that really matters, if you can get other people to believe, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, my point with all of this is that the connections to Abigail having her followers commit these horrific crimes that they probably wouldn't have done without being forced or persuaded fits with a tie-in with the Manson family. It would also suggest to me that Abigail might not have been hands-on in the actual murder part, because Charles Manson never killed anyone himself. He just got other people to do it for him.
I definitely agree with you there. I think that Renee did the actual killing. Mm-hmm. And this parallel, your argument here, cinches it for me.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
Another really exciting part for me, though, is when Strike makes another connection to the Manson family, because when we first got the sample of the book, I read that Kevin had written pigs on the wall and I gasped.
Mm-hmm. And you had been talking about the pigs thing in connection with the Manson family before the book even came out, right? When we knew it would be.
Yeah, when I got the sample. Yeah.
And we got that. I definitely remember you bringing this up.
I'm pretty sure I remember texting Bill. I sent him a picture from my copy of Helter Skelter, where it's a picture of death to pigs written on the wall at the scene of one of the murders.
Was this more of an attempt at a frame up, like what they thought a black person might write on the wall of a murderer?
I'm not totally sure if this was a framing attempt, but it's still somewhat connected to that, because pigs were kind of a thing in the Manson family because of two songs off of the White Album. So there was a song called Piggies, which has a lyric about what they need's a damn good whacking. And on Wikipedia, it says that Manson interpreted that as what the black community would do to the establishment or the pigs. And also the song Revolution 9, which is a very weird song. It has pig noises and gun noises, so he interpreted that as the violent overthrow of the white man. Normal stuff.
Sure.
Normal stuff.
Very reasonable.
Pigs were a big deal in the Manson family and in the UHC, at least with Abigail's crew. Anyway, this is just a fun connection to me. I even tweeted that once when we were talking about cults with Joe, and she liked it that I was saying how excited I was to catch that connection early on. She's probably thinking, you big weirdo.
Of all the things that you've tweeted, I don't think that that is what's most likely to make Joe think you're a weirdo.
Okay, that's fair.
I think you're good on that point.
Oh, the thirst tweets probably do that, don't they?
Much more effectively, yes.
Hey, we've seen recently that one of her best friends even has a thing for Strike. So she gets it.
Yeah.
It's her own fault. She knows what she's doing.
Yes.
Have I told you guys that I got to visit the prison where the Manson women are?
Oh.
It was for one of my college classes, correctional law. It ended up where my professor got to meet Susan Atkins, because he was invited to speak at a class that the prison gives for inmates who are about to be released. And she was the TA for that class because he was an ex-con. So it was all about how you go back into society and rebuild your life kind of thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that is really cool.
Anyway, I could talk about this forever, but back to the book. It's amazing how close they are to the truth and also amazing how obvious it feels in hindsight.
Very.
Because they're talking about the pig masks and the Polaroids, and Robin notes that there weren't any pig masks when she was there. So Strike theorizes that someone was doing this all privately and that it was someone who had enough authority to force others into it.
Which, of course, is spot on.
It is, yeah. J.K. Rowling's playing very fair here in terms of the mystery. She's leading us right to the answer, but she hides it so magnificently that we still don't see it.
So regarding the names that Carrie gave the people in the Polaroids, Rose and Joe, I still think that she made up both names on the spot. And it was just a lucky coincidence they happened to match two people who it could have been. Because we never got any actual confirmation that Joe Jackson was part of the UHC at the right time for this. And I'm skeptical that Carrie would remember a random teenager called Rosalind who was at the farm for 10 days more than 20 years ago. It seems much more likely to me that Strike was right about her picking Rose because she likes flower names, and Joe because she's not very creative and it starts with the same two letters as Jordan. But later in the book, they seem to just operate under the assumption that these IDs were correct because Robin finds a Rosie. And it just nags at me a bit because it was so obviously Jordan in the photos from his reaction and that tattoo cover up.
I don't know. I thought they were just investigating it.
Well, we'll see when we go forward if I'm remembering it correctly, but I remember it niggling at me afterwards.
I don't know. Her getting two names right feels less likely to me.
It feels lucky to me. I think she got really lucky with that red herring, but they felt made up still.
I don't know. She could have remembered Rosie because just the circumstances of their escape.
I mean, but if they say escaped that same night, which they did, Cherie probably would have had other more horrific things on her mind. But I guess there is no way to really know.
I have to read a comment that we got on Instagram from Kimberly. She said, fun thing I realized as I was listening to this episode, I think that Carrie slash Cherie was influenced to name her daughters Poppy and Daisy because those were the two flowers that bloomed at Chapman Farm. On page 448 in the chapter where Robin eavesdrops on Emily and Becca's conversation, it says, it was a hot, cloudless June day. Field poppies and daisies had bloomed along the path to the porta cabins, and Robin might have felt uplifted but for the fact that the fine weather at Chapman Farm turned her thoughts to all the places she'd rather have been.
Oh, I really like this because it points to the fact that though Cherie could physically escape Chapman Farm, it never really left her.
Yeah.
Right? It was that cloud falling around her whole life.
Yeah, that was a good catch. Strike and Robin start talking about the photographer of these Polaroids also being very responsible for what's going on. And this is another troubled blood parallel, isn't it? Because with Ricci being the one behind the camera and orchestrating something awful.
Oh, yep, it definitely is. This bit where Strike asks Robin if she could see Mazu forcing teenagers to take these pictures. I really love the way that Robin stops and thinks before she answers. And her answer itself is, if you'd asked me before I went in there whether a woman could make kids do that, I'd have said it was impossible, but she's not normal. I think she's a true sadist. I just like it because we've had several moments in these novels of Robin not believing a woman could do something so brutal. One of them was just a minute ago. But here we see the way that this time at Chapman Farm has affected her perception. She's seen evil, as she puts it in the rescue chapter, and she thought before that she knew what that was. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I just think it's a hint of the way Robin's experiences might affect her going forward, and that her perspective of the world has shifted a bit. She has a different understanding of what people are capable of.
Yeah, it's almost like it's her version of going to war. I don't know if that's nonsense, but you know, Strike's been, and now she has too.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Robin then gets a phone call from Murphy telling Robin that he got a tape of the interviews of the UHC members that were accusing her of child abuse.
Poor Strike pretending to be interested in the window
while unenthusiastically eating his apple. Such as me, it feels like Strike having to witness Murphy and Robin is tied to him in this book being miserable about eating healthy food. Or is it just that it happened once or twice and it made me laugh, so I imagine that it happened more often.
The only other time I can think is the broccoli. But I imagine anything he was doing would be unenthusiastic if he's listening to Robin talk to Murphy. You know, he's unenthusiastically sharpening a pencil or unenthusiastically buttoning his shirt.
Yeah.
Anything.
There was the more fucking fish that he abandoned for Bijou to.
Was I the only one absolutely terrified that Murphy was about to say he loved her over the phone? He wouldn't have heard it, but what would she have said back in front of Strike? I don't like thinking about this.
Yeah, I hate that. And this almost does happen after the car chase scene.
I know.
I couldn't have handled him.
No,
when I could hear that.
I couldn't either.
No. Oh, that was a perpetual fear. As soon as they had that I love you scene, it's like, oh God, no. Well,
now I'm still worried about this.
Yeah.
I'm worried about it all over again.
Oh, no.
I had no fears, and now I have one fear.
Yeah.
After he told her he loved her.
I know.
I can't. Oh, no. I'm not going to be able to handle that.
The only way I can handle it is if he says it to her over the phone and she just can't say it back to him in front of Strike. That would be amazing.
Yeah, that would be good.
But I'd be terrified for those few seconds.
Yeah.
Oof. Yeah.
I'm sweating thinking about it.
So Strike then realizes that not only does this mean that Robin and Murphy's relationship didn't fall apart while being separated, but it also says he not only resented Murphy being able to access information he couldn't, he resented Murphy being in a position to inform or assist Robin when he couldn't.
I don't care what anyone says. This is sweet. He wants to be her main man. He wants to be the one taking care of things for her, being able to give comfort and practical care.
I love it too. This resentment, in a larger sense, feels like it's maybe about his fear that Murphy offers Robin things that Strike can't. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about all of his insecurities in Ink Blackheart, wondering if he's deluded to think that Robin could be attracted to him.
Yeah.
So it's like a larger fear.
That makes it even sweeter.
Yeah.
But also, I'm bitter about this too. In the next chapter, we have to read about case stuff with Robin and Murphy. Ugh. It's just wrong.
Can you imagine the jealousy if Robin found out that Strike talked shop with Madeline? She'd have lost her mind.
Yeah, she would have.
So upset. No.
Just imagining that meme picture that has somebody's bed sheet draped across their front door and it says, "Welcome home, cheater."
Yep. Exactly.
But he does what he can for her here by distracting her with more questions about Cherie because he knows that she's really worried.
But I like this line here. Yet again, both sat in silence, but this time their thoughts were running on parallel tracks. Just because it's a little reminder of how in sync they are when it comes to work. Even when their lives are a mess or they're at odds with each other, they always connect over solving the mystery and finding justice. They are in the same groove there. They run in parallel, like they're holding hands with their brains.
That is simultaneously a very cute and a very creepy mental image. Thank you for that. I'm just imagining something similar to the Ood from Doctor Who.
The Ood! Oh, you have to remind me about the Ood.
Now I'm thinking that Josh Blaze should create a new character for the Ink Black Heart that's a brain with hands like Hardy.
Oh,
he can be brainy. And people get annoyed with him because he thinks he's smarter than everyone else.
Oh, I
love this. It would have to be an homage to Strike and Robin, right? Because then it turns out that Brainy is always smarter than everyone else and brings justice to the cemetery.
Justice to the cemetery.
Aww.
Justice. We sound like Gus trying to give Josh ideas.
Well, our ideas are good. So it's different.
The chapter ends with Strike basically saying that he doesn't believe that Dayu drowned, but that she was either murdered or still alive.
This makes me laugh because Robin points out how very different those two things are. And Strike says, "I know, but if we can prove it either way, the drowned prophet, pun intended, is dead in the water."
Oh my God. How have I never noticed that line before?
Yeah, that's good.
Hopefully that gave Robin a much needed laugh.
Yeah.
All right. Should we get into chapter 99?
Yes.
Yeah.
In this chapter, Murphy and Robin watch the interview with Becca about the allegations against Robin.
Oh boy. And the epigraph. This line is the representative of the evil that is to be rooted out. And that's hexagram 43, breakthrough resoluteness. I think this is referring to Becca. She is literally the representative of evil here, representing the UHC in this real world setting with the police.
Absolutely. I think you're right about this. Especially because this line continues, "The dark nature of the present line suggests that it knows how to silence those who would raise the warning. However, its kind must not be tolerated. Otherwise, it is to be feared that from the neglected solitary yin line, evil will sprout forth as from a seed." And that's just where we end the book with Becca, right? Mm-hmm. With Robin's fear that she's going to begin the whole cult again.
Yeah.
And, you know, this hexagram also refers more generally to the time when inferior people gradually begin to disappear. Mm. And I'm just saying that we're going to start seeing some more cracks in this Murphy-Robin relationship from here on in.
Oh, what a shame.
Really starting here for me.
Yeah. Are we ready for this?
Fun chapter. Oh, I'm ready.
I have to say, my husband told me that when the book first came out and I was reacting out loud to this, he was like, "You're just saying that because you don't like Murphy. It's not that bad." And I was like, "I'm sorry. Do you want to sleep on the couch?" He might as well have told me to calm down with the kind of response I gave him for that.
Oh, hell no.
He then tried to say, he's like, well, I only read it once, so I'll go back and reread it. And I'm like, okay, okay.
You do that and keep rereading it until the message gets through, bud.
You hear that? It's, he's listening. He listens to this.
Oh, sorry, David. Not all beards.
When Robin arrives at Murphy's flat, it says that it's similar to Robin's because it's also a cheap one-bedroom sort of place.
This feels like, to me, one of those things where they're compatible on paper. I think it's such a good setup for this chapter to show these ways where they should be a good match. But then what ends up happening with him shushing her, it shows their real incompatibility, which is later heavily highlighted by Strike and Robin yelling at the TV together.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
I feel like there are also a couple of things that compare Murphy with Strike when it comes to the description of his flat. It says Murphy has noisy downstairs neighbors, and we know that Strike has had that too.
Check.
The mention that Murphy's flat doesn't have a lift but stairs, we know that's a thing with the office, right?
Oh, yes.
And then just kind of the bareness of the flat. I mean, maybe Joe's making a joke about men and their decorating skills, because all I have to say is if it wasn't for me, this house would be totally blank. So not wrong if that's what she's joking about.
I buck the stereotype because I am terrible at decorating. I'm so bad at it.
I'm just pointing out that I get the sense that everything outside of Robin's thoughts, they're trying to compare Murphy to Strike, right? It's, there's so many comparisons being screamed at Robin here, but she's like, la, 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 you know?
I can't hear you. I can't see you.
Yeah.
I do not acknowledge your existence.
Exactly. So I'll give my husband one thing here where I hate this part just because it's Murphy. So it's when she says, oh, wonderful, about there being food. Me or the food, asks Murphy, bending to kiss her. You forgetting the food. Ugh. I just want to barf at this part because it is sweet or whatever, which means that I hate it. I'm like, shut up, Murphy. Just go away.
They're not allowed to be cute together. It's just not allowed. Reported.
Yeah. Hate crime. Hate crime reported. Absolutely. I feel personally victimized.
Personally victimized by this line. Being cute. Yeah. I mean, it is. It is kind of cute. I'm outraged that he's feeding her curry. How dare he? That is Strike and Robin's special meal.
How dare you pick a very popular meal? Yeah.
Yes. How he is dare. Not allowed to usurp the memory of their curry and whiskey night.
It's like, you got coffee?
Yeah, how dare you?
That's Strike and Robin's thing.
That's Strike and Robin's
drink. How dare you?
Rude. Offensive. Yes, you're picking up what I'm putting down here. All of this is incredibly offensive to me personally.
Right.
All of that belongs to Strike and Robin.
I get it.
We have to go back to the whole thing with the map, though, and Murphy's attempt at decorating. It's very funny.
Joe actually tweeted about this, that there's nothing wrong with maps, but that she thinks it's funny that that's the only thing he can think of as decorating.
I mean, it is a bit funny, but honestly, I would totally hang an antique map of London in my wall because it's antique. It makes it classy. I give a point to Murphy for this because, yeah, it makes me laugh and it is also relatable.
But would you hang a map of your own city? Does it make it better or weirder that Murphy does this? Although I suppose if you live in a city like London, it would be different.
Yeah, I mean, I probably wouldn't hang a map of the city I currently live in.
No, me either.
There's not much to it.
But if I lived in London.
Yeah, if I lived in London.
Sure.
You know, it could also serve as a very useful piece of decor. Because what if a solar storm knocks out your GPS, your communications? You're going to need a map of London to coordinate whatever, right? You got one right there.
Yeah, forget actual maps. Go peel the one off the wall.
Yeah. Well, it's a handy one. You know, it's
is right it
there? Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Okay. You know what this makes me think of, though? When Robin tells Strike that she loves London and he says, so do I.
Yeah.
I wonder if Murphy also loves London and that's why he picked the map, or if it's just really because he can't think of anything else. Maybe he doesn't like London and he'll want to move somewhere far, far away.
Oh, yeah. Spain should be far enough.
Anywhere. Literally anywhere.
Surely anywhere else. Yeah.
I guess we do see Robin comparing Strike and Murphy's flats, though. I guess she feels safe to compare that instead of them.
Like comparing by proxy.
Yeah.
The loophole. No, Robin.
It says, of course, Strike's flat was the same in that there were no decorative objects there at all, except for the school photo of his nephews Lucy never failed to send him, which was updated yearly. However, the fact that Strike lived under the eaves gave his flat a certain character, which was entirely lacking in Murphy's identikit dwelling.
Strikes has character. Oh, Robin.
She's got it bad.
Yeah. She's
Down bad.
She is down bad.
Even in this one thing that she allows herself to compare, Strike is still winning.
And it's the category of your decorated apartment, which the bar's so fucking low with Strike. How does Murphy tango underneath it?
I guess it just reflects how she feels when she's in these spaces, right?
Yeah. Oh,
Strike's
yeah.
flat has character because it's his. She can mention the Eaves all she wants. She's not fooling me.
No, she's not fooling
No.
anyone.
Although I would like an Eve.
Yeah,
I can
well.
see how that would be nice, but still, Robin.
I'd like to note, though, that Strike has also hung up a drawing of a soldier that Jack did for him and Jack's excellent history report that he was super proud of. So it's not just the yearly photo that has something conveniently placed in front of the oldest one.
That's true.
He's also got some really cute stuff about Jack up.
That's very cute.
So that's a plus for Strike
It
that
is.
Murphy does not have. Where are all the photos of his sister?
Does he have nieces and nephews?
Does he? We don't know, do we?
It had taken a couple of visits to Robin's own flat for Murphy to comment aloud, with an air of faint surprise, that pictures and plants made a surprising difference to a space, which had made Robin laugh. However, she hadn't made the slightest attempt to change Murphy's flat. No gifted cushions or posters, no helpful suggestions. She knew such things might be interpreted as a proprietorial statement of intent, and with all its drawbacks, her own flat was dear to her for the independence it gave her.
Robin's thoughts there about not ever wanting to give any implication that she wants to live with Murphy, I think is what it's saying, right?
Yeah.
Feels so much like Strike to me and how he's thought of his past relationships and not really wanting more or what his actions imply to the other, you
Yeah.
know?
Yeah. He carefully thinks through all of his stuff too.
Yeah, that was my exact thought. This sounds very much like a Strike from previous books.
It's interesting that she's very aware and careful of the message she doesn't want to send in this regard, but then in other areas like ignoring the kid thing and accidentally saying, I love you back, she's being way less careful and maybe deliberately not looking at the message he's going to take from those things.
I think it might have to do with what would cause direct conflict versus what wouldn't. Because he's never going to say, how come you don't give me decorating tips? But he might have a lot to say if she told him she thinks she doesn't want children. But this is a pretty big acknowledgement from Robin to herself of what she doesn't want. And there's nothing wrong with that, except for maybe that she's not really open about not wanting that.
Yeah, it's a big old lie of omission.
I still wonder if we might get a contrast to this when it comes to Strike, where Robin gets him a gift like this or realizes that living with Strike would not feel like giving up her independence.
Oh, I hope we get to see something like this. I really want to see them navigate a relationship together and have these realizations about how different everything is when it's each other.
You know, for some reason, this whole thing is reminding me of that line from Lethal White a while after Lorelai tells Strike that she loves him and he says, "What do you want?" He said, losing his temper at last. "Me to limp up the fucking aisle, not feeling what I should feel, not wanting it, wishing I was out of it. You're making me say what I don't want to say. I didn't want to hurt anyone, but you did. You did hurt me, and now you want to walk away as though nothing happened." I'm just getting a feeling that we might see something similar to this scene in the future with Robin and a certain Met detective.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, that's a very good connection. I could totally see it.
Also, are we going to get at one point Strike limping up the aisle, feeling what he should feel, wanting nothing more than to marry you, Robin, happier there than he'd ever been anywhere else?
Yes,
Yes, we are.
not limping though, because he's healthier now.
Oh, right. Yes, not limping. So every single
Running.
part of it is improved. Racing up the
Running.
aisle. Yeah, booking it to get up there. We're definitely getting that in my mind.
That's a cute mental image. This is also where we learn that Murphy has been the one that's been taking care of Robin's plants.
Oh, I was not happy about this.
Not happy
Same.
about the job he did, or not happy that he was the one doing it?
I was not happy that he was the one doing it. I know he's her literal boyfriend, fine,
But
but
still,
still.
yeah, no.
He gets plant rights?
Rude.
With Strike's
That's her
plants?
plant child.
He killed two of them, and
Murderer.
thankfully, for his own sake, Phyllis survived. I
Yeah.
would have killed him.
Oh, 100%.
jumped into the book like the page master.
Oh, that was such a good movie.
Right?
I loved that movie as a kid. Oh my God. We have a movie in common. That movie was so fucking good.
Kenz, have you ever seen The Page Master?
I don't think I've ever even heard of that.
A kid who jumps into different books. I don't remember much of any of it. He gets like
stuck in an old library because he's scared, and he's transported into book worlds.
Yeah.
And jumps around.
Which is the literal dream.
The literal dream.
I think I remember people jokingly predicting that Murphy would accidentally kill her plant, and that would be the real reason they end up breaking up.
It would be justified.
Yeah. But how appropriate. The plant Strike gives her is the one that survives. Because yes, the love between Strike and Robin is bloody hard to kill Murphy, you know. But nice try. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
I think that's exactly what it's saying. It's sweetheart plant. Yeah, it is. And how adorable is it that Robin named only the plant that Strike got for her? Mm. Obviously, it's because it's special to her. This is just as cute to me as Robin noticing CBS on the license plate in Ink Black Heart because it's Strike's initials.
Oh my God, she is adorable.
I know.
She is down bad. She's so
good. Down bad. Also, can we get a scene where Strike finds out that she gave the plant a name, please? Because I'm guessing he would also find that adorable and very endearing.
He would. 100%. And I get that Phyllis is short for philodendron, but the name Phyllis also means leafy foliage. So it's a perfect name. But you know what else Phyllis means?
What?
Sweetheart.
Are you serious? That is so cute.
I know.
I just think of Phyllis from The Office.
I know, me too. So my mind immediately goes to that Phyllis.
Grossly inappropriate with Bob Vance from Vance Refrigeration.
Or when she's listening to the audiobook. Was she listening to 50 Shades on audio? Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking about the gifts we know Strike has given Robin. You know, an expensive dress to tell her she looks gorgeous, a perfume that he clearly thought was sexy, a house plant with heart leaves known as a sweetheart plant. I mean, come on.
Seriously, this man's heart eyes can be seen from space.
We know how much Matthew hated that dress. I wonder if Murphy is ever going to find out about any of the gifts Strike has given her, because they're all pretty telling. I mean, the plant is pretty safe, but there's a suggested level of closeness with its gifts.
Yeah, I hope so. Give me all the drama.
Yeah, it would be great.
I can't wait for the drama. I'm ready for it. A spoon. I'm so excited.
When Murphy starts to warn Robin about the video, he's trying to explain that Becca sounds insane or things she's saying are just off or weird. It's a little funny to me because he's trying to explain to Robin how crazy the UHC sounds. Like, she knows, bud. She's there.
Front row seat.
Yeah, he's just trying to reassure her that there's nothing to worry about, but he's totally preaching to the choir. She knows.
It is quite comforting in a way to know from Murphy that the bullshit is obvious to the viewers, to the cops. Because Becca could have hidden it and come off as credible.
Right.
I already knew that Robin wasn't going to be charged. But after seeing this video where Becca goes to Crazy Town Banana Pants in the same tone as she gave her evidence, I knew. I'm like, oh, okay, nothing's going to happen.
Yeah.
She's good.
I love how furious Robin is to find out that Louise gave testimony against her. She's so offended. Louise wasn't openly hostile to her, and Robin's she's so offended by it.
Louise? Yeah. I laughed a bit at I'd expected a Vivian, because Vivian's a snake. Would.
I bet getting Louise to do this was more about punishing her than anything else, though. Imagine having to go testify that the son who just died never even existed, and that this woman who tried to help him is lying. They're just so cruel.
I hadn't even thought of that, but that's viciously cruel. I wonder if they threatened Louise to get her to do this, or if she's just been so broken down by them that they don't have to threaten her anymore.
Louise is starting to be one of those characters who I worry about after the book. I just feel so bad for her, and I can't help but wonder how she's ever going to survive outside. You know, it's not like she has her whole life ahead of her, and we know she has bad arthritis. Her only family left hates her. This poor woman. It's awful.
Before we get to the tape, I noticed that Robin says that the policeman on the video looks like one of the officers who interviewed her at Felbert Lodge.
I'm so curious about how much Murphy knows about that night. So obviously he knows they were interviewed by the police in a room. Mm-hmm. But does he know that they slept there? Does he think they had separate rooms or that they drove home after the interview?
Ooh.
I want to know.
Ooh, maybe he finds out in Hallmarked Man.
Mm. I hope he does. And I hope he hates it.
Oh,
I,
yeah.
Sorry, I don't mean to sound so excited about that idea, yeah, but
I'm excited.
Murphy would not like this.
I very much want him to find out that Robin was full of shit about the lawyer Strike was dating. I want him
Me
to be
too.
Like, oh, so how's that lawyer you're dating? Strike's like, what,
what
do you want about?
Like, what?
Lawyer.
Oh, it's so gonna be so good.
Oh my goodness.
Robin behind Murphy just like, no.
It's going to be like that scene with Madeline on the phone where he lies that he's that was room service.
Oh, that would be so good.
It's going to be like that.
Delicious.
All right, let's get to Becca's interview.
Okay. I was screaming at the book just like Robin was screaming at the screen when Becca says that she oversees their homeschooling program because I actually homeschool my kid.
Yeah.
These four kids are getting the bare minimum to just be able to write in their notebooks.
The hypocrisy of this whole speech is infuriating.
Yeah.
The maths postgrad, they're better than A levels. What? A philosophy professor? What? Because the readers witnessed this horrible neglect right alongside Robin. We are right here with her on this. We're in her shoes screaming. And in a way, Murphy is also pausing on us.
Which, how dare he pause my screaming in anger?
How dare he indeed? No one pauses pools. Okay.
I can attest to that. That's the truth. I try.
But we can't. Yet, you cannot. The mute button is the best you can do.
This brings us to the first time that Murphy pauses.
I think my instant reaction was, oh, we're not going to do that, are we?
Yeah. I was instantly like,
what's happening right now?
Offended face.
We got an email about this a long time ago, and we made a note of it so that we wouldn't forget. And there's no name given, probably for privacy, but here's what it says. Hi, love the podcast. I just wanted to say that as someone who experienced a cult very similar to the UHC, what Murphy did in chapter 99 is despicable, not allowing her to argue back with video Becca. She's been in a cult. How many opportunities does he think she's had to argue with their awful ideology? Robin needs a place to be safe to argue back against the cult's brainwashing, against their ideas, and of course, against the false accusations they're hurling at her in order to regain a sense of power in being free to clearly state and defend reality. The fact that Murphy denies this to her when it's a freaking video, you can replay it, really makes me hate him as much as Matthew, maybe even more.
That's saying something.
That is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First of all, thank you so much to this person for sharing your own experience and offering your insight, because I'm right there with you on this being the opposite of what Robin needs. And I have been since the very first time I read this chapter. I found it infuriating because Murphy might have had good intentions, but he should have just let Robin argue, let her vent. He's seen the video. He knows where the important bits are if he needs to rewind. I feel like she needs this catharsis. Like you said, having the power to state reality and truth when it's been denied to you is really, really important. I get that. Murphy just, he doesn't understand what she needs. He might be trying to do his best, but he's wrong. Unlike Strick. Who's arguing right there alongside with her.
Does anyone want to argue that he's pausing to just make sure Robin hears everything, give her time to vent? I feel like in order to be fair, we have to consider this, right? This is probably what the counter argument would be. But I do believe that we're meant to not like this, and it's meant to be a comparison to her and Strike later on.
Yeah, the fact that she later stops herself and apologizes when Murphy goes to pause again, that's what makes me think he wasn't giving her that space to vent. You know, at least she didn't take it that way. It was a very Pavlov thing. I might be wildly exaggerating that, but it's what it felt like to me. I don't like being paused at, you know.
I don't know. You're going to be surprised, but I actually didn't mind him doing this as a concept.
Oh,
I know, shocker.
I think the most shocking thing is this the first time we're hearing about this.
Probably because I don't feel so strongly about it that I bring it up whenever we talk about it.
But you can talk about how you feel.
Yeah.
About things, even if it's different than us.
Well, no, but I don't feel particularly strongly one way or the other about it. That's what I'm trying to say.
As opposed to us, who are both.
Yeah, you guys have very strong opinions about that. I can see it from both sides, because like on one hand, it sort of reminds me of when people are talking over like movies or TV shows while you're trying to watch them. And it's like, if you're trying to watch it to watch it and retain information, then unless you're reacting like in a, oh my God, like a short sort of exclamation sort of way, then yes, I would be pressing pause, waiting until you're done and then continuing. So in that sort of sense, it doesn't really bother me, because I think that maybe Murphy's thinking is that, especially if he thinks that all the later stuff with Cherie is all just bullshit and this is the bulk of whatever information it is that she needs to you know, listen to and retain, that maybe he's thinking that she just needs to retain all of that stuff that she's hearing so she can make notes for the case. And that would be the most important part. But again, he doesn't know her well enough to know that that's what she needs, which isn't entirely his fault, but I can get why it bothers her.
I suppose he might, to give him, I guess, the benefit of the doubt, he might be thinking he doesn't want her to have to watch it twice because it's so awful. Like, because, yeah, they could just rewind it. But it would make sense, I guess. Except I think she'd feel better watching it a second time. Once she gets all of her anger out, then she can put on her, you know, objective detective hat for the whole thing.
For me, it's the general idea of being shushed when you're angry or told to be quiet. Mm-hmm. Like you, Pools, I hated this right away. And maybe I'm being overly sensitive, but the idea of shushing a woman who is angry about injustices, something that's been done to her, it's just, it's an ick for me. I don't think Murphy would appreciate being shushed, or that he would be in the first place. And I can't imagine, even though my husband says he doesn't think this was that bad, I can't imagine trying to tell him something that I experienced that was traumatic and having him tell me not to react or not to be angry about watching that injustice unfold right in front of my eyes. I don't think it's quite the same thing as someone just talking during a movie, because yeah, that's super annoying. I agree with you, Kenz, about that. But it's about what was done to her and not being allowed to say out loud what the truth is.
Yeah, I mean, if my husband is talking over a movie, I'll absolutely pause it and glare at him until he shuts up. He has the worst timing for that, and his voice is just pitched perfectly to drown out any TV show. It drives me crazy. Oh, it drives me nuts. But they're watching this for her, not for him to hear what's going on.
Yeah.
He means well, I'm sure, but just it ain't it.
I mean, I'm sure that there are a lot of people that agree with you, Kenz, but just really don't like it.
We might be the unpopular opinions here. I think a lot of people are going to be like, you're overreacting. Maybe.
Because I don't think that, I'm not sure that he was doing it with the intention of controlling her emotional reactions to it.
It's not about her intention, though.
Yeah, it's just about the effect.
We might have to agree to disagree about whether or not this is about the overall sort of like controlling how, like, I get what you're saying. I just don't think that that's what that is.
I don't think he's trying to control her. I just think it's so normal for people to be like, shh, it's not that big of a deal.
But is that what he's actually saying here? That it's not a big deal? Or is it that he just wants her to watch it?
It's what your actions say to somebody. If you're shushing someone when they're trying to express their anger, to me, that says you don't think that I deserve to feel this way. It doesn't matter if he intends that or if that's what he's saying, but that's what it would say to me as the person being shushed.
But going back to the movie, the movie, it's not a movie.
The worst movie ever.
The worst movie. I can't get over the blatant lies about the education that these kids are getting. Fully qualified primary school teachers. Do you mean Shauna, who can't read? Like, I really hope that this educational neglect featured hugely in Fergus Robertson's stories about the cult. I feel like Robin should quietly tip him off about just how terrible it was. And let her
I'm
read.
Sorry. That's not funny, but it is. Shauna, who can't read, is the fully qualified teacher.
Yikes. I'm trying to imagine this interview from that cop's perspective, though. Because, I mean, just the night before this, he'd interviewed Robin in that room. He'd seen the state of her, heard her whole story, how much she wanted them to go into that farm and find that kid. Surely he must be able to see how obviously retaliatory and false the whole accusation is, right?
I want to believe that.
Yeah.
After watching American Nightmare on Netflix, I just have no faith left.
Yeah.
You mentioned this earlier, and I do hate when she stops her own self and says, I'm sorry. Mm. But she can't help it when they talk about Jacob being a different, healthy child. And that would infuriate me too.
Yeah. The next time that she screams at the screen is when Becca said that she was trying to take a picture of Jacob's genitalia. How?
Exactly.
She had to sneak out in the middle of the night to write notes in a rock. And yet somehow she's supposed to be taking pictures with her camera phone.
It is kind of a parallel to what actually happened, though, years before, isn't it?
Oh,
someone was taking pictures of that.
Oh, good point. That did actually kind of happen.
That's funny, though, because Robin asking how she would have done that is actually something that she needs to answer. How would someone do that?
How would someone do that?
Murphy finally pauses it for good to check in with Robin when she loses it over Becca saying that they take child safeguarding very seriously. And there's never been an accusation of sexual abuse at the farm. I'd be punching a wall or something.
Yeah. How she's not just hulking out with rage here is just beyond me.
When she can't even find the words, she just points it back and is like, It's very, it's Umbridge level rage, right?
It's like the evil monkey on Family Guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's Umbridge level rage. That kind of rage that Voldemort doesn't inspire, Umbridge inspires it.
Yeah. And Murphy doesn't do anything wrong when he stops and puts his arm around her.
Yeah.
But when he says that he shouldn't have shown her this and should have just told her about it, I just don't agree, because that's more of what Linda wants, to shield her like she's not a grown woman. And that's not going to help her.
Yeah, exactly. And if there's anything that Robin hates, it's being treated with kid gloves.
Yep.
You want to play a game of what would Strike have done?
Well, I think that a hug definitely still would have been in order.
Well, I won't argue with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's top of the list. Big ol' hug. Mm-hmm. I think that he probably would have just let her vent. He wouldn't have said that he shouldn't have shown it to her, or that all of it was bullshit or whatever. He probably would have just asked her if she felt okay to continue and validated her feelings of anger, because he understands.
I feel like he probably would have been angry at Becca right along with her. Right? Like, remembering his own time at the farm and having read Robin's report about what she saw, he would have had some choice words of his own to say. They could have roasted Becca together, make like a drinking game out of it, take a shot every time you want to reach through the screen and slap the lies out of her mouth.
Yeah.
But of course, he'd have already taken thorough notes about what's relevant, so it doesn't matter if they miss anything, right?
Yeah. I love that. I'll give this one to Murphy. When Robin apologizes, he says, yeah, it's like you've just escaped from a cult or something.
He's clearly trying to be, you know, understanding, kind, gentle, whatever. But what Robin needs is justice and more cake. I feel like she hasn't had enough cake yet. Justice and cake.
So they fast forward to the part where Becca talks about Cherie.
She had briefly mentioned her earlier when she said another woman used a fake name. What is her real name?
I believe her birth name was Corrine Makepeace.
Okay.
Yeah. And then she went by Cherie after Chapman Farm when she was with the Isaac Mills guy.
She has a thing for C names.
Mm-hmm.
I still think she's connected to Charlotte because of the suicide mother of two.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's a shush. Oh, a shush.
Shush. And she's being shushed. Oh, we're connecting the dots.
Ridiculous.
Here's what Becca says about Cherie. Cherie was a messenger of the blessed divinity sent to take Dayu, our prophet, to the sea. Cherie confided her purpose to me.
Normal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very sane. Very normal.
Now, this is when Murphy starts to talk over Becca. And can I just say that literally nothing gave me more satisfaction than Robin shushing Murphy back.
Right? Yes.
Oh, it was so funny to me. I feel like Robin understands when it's time to pay attention to the case and when it's okay to vent, you know? Because look at her now. She's in full detective mode when she hears useful information.
Which is hilarious, because it's the one bit of the interview that Murphy just completely writes off.
He's mostly interested in this because the obvious, you know, nuttery of it really throws into question Becca's credibility. He has no idea.
And I'm relieved to see that she doesn't actually discuss the case with Murphy, does she?
No, she doesn't.
She is only discussing the potential charges.
Yeah.
I find it really creepy that Becca said she believes Cherie will come back to them one day and bring her little girls. Oof, how does she know Cherie has little girls?
I believe the church was keeping tabs on these people. You know, it's like how they knew where to send the letters to Deirdre Doherty's husband. I think Wace would definitely want to keep track of Cherie, especially because of her involvement with Dayu's death. But it's just that Abigail was also keeping tabs on these same key people, and she's the one who acts on it.
For some reason, I really like Becca talking about Robin escaping and some man being there to pick her up. Yeah, he was.
Her main man.
Yeah, and I like Murphy hearing about it.
For some reason, I thought that Becca had said a big man was there to pick her up. I must have dreamed that.
I think someone does say that. Maybe Will.
Oh, yeah.
Someone does say big man, I think.
Yeah, I think Will does. We'll have to keep an eye out for it, because just like hearing Strike described that way.
Weird.
So weird. Some big, hairy bear of a man was there to pick her up. I don't know. Crazy.
Weird that we would like that. It doesn't sound like us.
No.
Definitely not. When Robin says that she's shocked to realize that Becca truly believes all of this, Murphy's response is, I suppose that's a cult for you.
Yeah. Again, there's nothing wrong with this. It kind of rubs me the wrong way a little bit, because it's almost like dismissing the parts that Robin's most interested in.
Mm.
It seems to me like if she had said that to Strike, they would have talked a little bit more about that. But this feels like he's kind of brushing it off like,
feels like he kind of accepts just the easy answer, you know, and it's like he did with the Havening and Ink Black Heart. I think he's just not that great a detective, at least when you compare him to Robin and Strike.
Well, that's hardly fair.
Well, no, but still.
I know this might be a stretch, but a couple chapters ago, we have Strike telling Robin to eat her crisps.
Yeah.
We talked about that and how it said that she did what she was told. She accepts care from Strike or instructions from Strike. Here, Murphy tells her to eat her curry, and she says she will, but she needs to call Strike first. She doesn't do what he tells her to do. I love it.
Me too. I bet Murphy was pleased about her immediately going off to call Strike.
Yeah.
Narrative voice, he was not pleased.
No.
No.
I also love watching her say to a boyfriend that she's going to call Strike. Because remember with Matthew where she had to pretend it was Vanessa on the phone. She's never able to do this with Matthew. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of what Joe said in the Q&A where she talked about her relationship with Murphy. How Robin has something she hasn't had before. This fits in with that for me. I don't know if it'll stay that way. But I like that for now, she's still able to prioritize her work and Strike.
Yeah. For now being the operative word, right? Because I think we're starting to see, you know, some cracks in this. Oh, he lets her prioritize her work and Strike, especially later on in this book, and maybe even more coming up in the Hallmarked Man. Fingers crossed.
Let's go to chapter 100.
How is that even possible?
Oh, you know what else I love Jo saying when she doesn't accept the criticism about these books are too long? Well, that's because it's how long I want it to be. That's how long it takes to tell the story.
Jo, I think you should make them longer.
No, she's going to say, that's how long it takes, Pools.
Well, I feel like maybe you could take a little bit longer if you wanted to. I'm just saying.
She doesn't accept your criticism, Pools.
Damn it. I want 2,000 pages.
Okay, chapter 100. In this chapter, Strike finds out that Cherie has been found dead.
And the epigraph to chapter 100 reads, 9 in the second place means dragon appearing in the field. From Hexagram 1, the creative.
This one's a little trickier. When I think of the image of a dragon appearing in a field, it feels far off to me. There's a danger, but it's not quite reaching us yet. And maybe that's what's happening with Abigail trying to break into the office with the gun and Cherie's death.
It is tricky, isn't it? I mean, in the I Ching, the dragon represents not danger, but the dynamic, arousing, creative force. In this hexagram, the dragon is the symbol for the great man. And this line specifically refers to the great man beginning to manifest his power and distinguish himself. It's a positive symbol, right? Which clearly doesn't make much sense with what's going on in this chapter. So I have to assume that this line, Jo chose more for the symbolism it would hold for a Western audience, right? Where the dragon is seen, where it's like danger appearing with Abigail and Cherie, which is a convoluted way of saying that, yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Also, we later learn that the field where the UHC buries all the bodies is the Dragon Meadow. So, sign of another death that appears to have been caused by the UHC?
Yeah.
Maybe.
So at the beginning here, I can't help but feel like Jo's laying it on thick that Strike is alone and sad that Robin's over at her boyfriend's. You know, it says that he ate a solitary meal and he feels the familiar faint depression as he makes his way home, wishing Robin would call him.
He's so in love. Bless him.
We need a contrast when we get there about how completely happy both of them are all the time.
Yes, please. Anyway, in this beginning, we get a little reminder about how close the agency actually is physically to the UHC, because it says that Strike's eating his dinner, which is noodles, by the way.
Oh, that is funny, because Robin refuses to eat the noodles over the... Yep, oh my gosh.
The noodles.
That's great. It's a little connection, isn't
it? Whenever they get takeout in the future,
Strike will eat the noodles for her.
Noodles for her. And she'll never have to eat noodles again.
Yeah. Although I feel like I would get over that eventually.
I too would get over that because I love fucking noodles.
Like, me too.
They're going to be
pasta
tasty
is
noodles.
Forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Forever. She'll get over it.
I agree.
Oh, anyway, sorry.
I can't fathom the idea of never eating noodles again.
Never? So. He'd watched a couple of people in blue tracksuits passing at a slow walk, deep in conversation, before turning into Rupert Court. He couldn't make out their faces, but was ill-natured enough to hope they were fretting about the private detective who'd been undercover at their precious farm for 4 months. First of all, precious farm is funny. He's funny. Yeah. You precious little farm. Fuck you. But that's not ill nature, babe. No. That's called justified loathing and smugness and also being proud of your amazing wife, right?
Agreed.
That's all wrapped up in there. But I also love that Strike is over here internally roasting UHC members. At the same time, his wife is being silenced from doing the same.
Ooh, very
good. He's thinking her thoughts at them.
Yep.
For her. Yeah.
And I do think he is very happy that she does call him.
Yeah. he sees her number and he's like, oh, whoa, whoa.
This is when we get his silly joke when she asks if he can talk and he says he's been doing it for years. Please note Robin's funny. Sarcastic, very funny response because she doesn't give fake laughs to Strike.
It was really funny though. I've actually cracked up. It was taking some power not to actually laugh at that.
I know I've joked before about Robin giving fake laughs to Murphy and fake other things to Matthew, but it's kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
She's not fully able to be herself with anyone except Strike. He's the only person she lets in all the way.
This whole conversation that Strike and Robin have is pretty much about all the people they know have been tracked since leaving the UHC and that they all have a connection to either Dayu or Deirdre's death. So we have Cherie and Jordan connected to Dayu's death. We have Ralph Doherty, Deirdre's ex-husband, who receives the fake letters from Deirdre after her death. And then there's Kevin, and they don't know how much Kevin had put together about Dayu's death at the time.
Yeah, so what's actually going on with all of this? Kevin, Cherie, and Jordan were watched and followed by Abigail because they knew about her crime. And we know that Flora was made by the UHC to write those fake letters to Ralph Doherty. So Abigail and the UHC are keeping tabs on people in order to cover up their own murders.
Plus, I think that the UHC also had a close eye on Kevin because of his blog that he was writing, exposing them, right? And his book. They'd sick their lawyers on him, so they were up to date on where he was too. All that Jonathan Wace would have had to do is to say that person's an enemy of the church, and then his underlings are gonna do the rest, no questions asked, right?
Enemies of the air beware.
Yeah. Oh.
But that's giving major Scientology vibes.
Oh, big time.
Enemies of the church, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is such a tiny little thing, but knowing how curious Robin has always been about where Strike is and what he's doing, I can't help but notice that she hears his footsteps on the metal stairs and must register that he's home. Yeah. You know, I'm sure she's making a mental note that he's not out with another bijou or something. You know she
thank
is.
Thank God.
All right, so when Strike got to the office, he noticed someone had tried to get past the new lock, and he watched the footage from his new security camera.
How have they not installed a security camera before this? Like, they were sent a leg 4 books ago. The whole thing with Billy running away from the office in Lethal White. Last book, they were bombed. You'd think that Strike would have implemented some serious security measures before this?
I guess the only one of them who was actually up at the office was Billy, and he wasn't a threat to them.
Yeah, true, but having his picture still would have been a bit useful for the first part of that whole thing. You know?
I guess it depends on how clear the video is.
It wouldn't have worked for story TM purposes.
Yeah. Yes, true. Good point, Kenz. Yes.
So he sees a figure in all black trying to break in, but not making any attempt to go upstairs, which suggests whoever this is doesn't know Strike lives up there, ruling LJ out.
Yeah.
And that was a relief to me because I was worried about Strike.
I feel like the general air of competence that this figure has would also have ruled out Little John. But yeah, but maybe that's just me being petty. I don't know.
That's okay. We like it.
Yeah. Yep, you're not wrong.
I know these are books, but it's so lucky he did this because of Patterson. Mm-hmm. Because now they know that someone with a gun is after them. And we all know that this is Abigail.
Yeah, Abigail for sure.
But it only made me more sure that it was the UHC because we've heard so many rumors about them having guns. Which I know that's what we were supposed to believe.
And I think we're definitely also supposed to connect this person to whoever killed Kevin with the not a novice line and the fact that Kevin's murderer used skeleton keys and was a stocky bloke in black.
Yeah.
Which I don't find it super credible that no one could tell that this is a woman just because she was tall and broad, because they've done studies analyzing people's gaits and most people can identify a male versus a female walking from just like a few points of light and connected lines traced onto a figure, and then the rest of it blacked out.
How is she described when we first meet her? Because he watches her walk, right?
Yeah.
Hold on real quick.
She has a really broad back, and she's very attractive.
He knew her to be in her mid-30s, but her hair, which was tied back in a ponytail, was already gray. Strangely, it not only suited her, but made her look younger. Her skin being fine. She nodded greetings to a couple men at the bar, then spotted him, and strode long-legged towards his table. Oh, hold on. Her rear view showed a lot of muscle, which made him reflect at his own daily exercises. She was almost as broad across the back as the man nearest her, who evidently found her very attractive, though she didn't seem to return interest.
Hmm.
Yeah, I guess the she's almost as broad as the man is.
Yeah, confusing things.
I guess it also depends on the security cameras, the quality. Yeah,
the quality of the cameras. Plus, again, it's this story and he can't figure it out too quickly.
Right. It also just reminds me we've had this kind of, you know, Bristow in disguise on a security camera.
Oh, yeah. In black. And they thought he was a black man, but he was a white man with the black.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I hate to say it, but you connected the dots. You connected them.
Do you hate to say it?
Just because I feel like I've overdone it at this point. But you connected them. I think that counts as a parallel.
Yeah.
Anyway, going back to
possibly
my original point.
Who knows anymore?
Who knows? I veered wildly off course once again. I think that my point was that we're supposed to connect this figure also to who killed Kevin.
Yeah.
And since we're all very sure that the UHC killed Kevin at this point,
right,
it checks out that this is the UHC for me.
And I remember letting out a huge gasp when it said that this figure tried to use the gun to break the window. The window that says the Strike and Ellicott Detective Agency.
Mm-mm.
The window that made Robin cry happy tears. The window that meant I couldn't stop smiling for days after finishing Ink Black Heart.
Mm.
How dare she?
Rude.
Jail for 1,000 years.
Straight to jail. Thank fuck that Strike had it reinforced when it was put in. He was not going to let anything break that window. He was thinking ahead.
Yeah, nothing can break it because their partnership is strong and it's unbreakable.
Oh. Stronger than ever, even.
Yeah. Oh, it's just like with Phyllis. Aww. We are given in back-to-back chapters the idea that their love, mm-hmm, in the form of a sweetheart plant, a name, cannot die. And then the idea that their partnership in glass form cannot be broken.
That's very sweet. I like that.
I know.
Next is when Strike gets a phone call from Carrie Curtis Woods's husband. And this is really awful. He's screaming, What did you do to my wife? And finally, police officer comes on the phone and tells Strike that Cherie hung herself.
I can't help but notice the officer's name is Waters. Just another water connection. It's an important liquid in this book.
Very important. Yes.
Have we talked about how in Troubled Blood, water feels so much about renewal? And even though we have such strong themes of baptism in this book, the water associations really feel like they're mostly about death.
Yes. And that doesn't bode well for Mr. Sea Warrior. Does it? Murphy means Sea Warrior.
Oh, how sad.
Well, yeah.
Sad so for sad. Him.
I cry a tear.
One tear.
Well, it's okay. I'm dehydrated, so.
Yep.
But water is much more sinister and ominous in this book, right? It's like, it's
dangerous.
We're plunging the depths of water. And down there, there's sharks.
There's scary stuff in the ocean.
Scary shit down there.
All right, what are we doing next time?
We are doing chapters 101 through 103. And in those chapters, Strike and Robin hold a team meeting, and they also meet Will at the office.
Oh, that's a good one.
Very exciting.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com. or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.